All right, we will continue this morning in our study of the minor prophets. So I invite you to turn to Habakkuk chapter 1. I will not ask you to spell it, but Brother Bray said he could do that. It's easy, I-T. There you go. So, if you can't find Habakkuk, go to Matthew and then back up three or four books, and you'll find it that way pretty easily. But Habakkuk chapter 1 is where we are. We looked at this a couple of weeks ago, the introductory material. And basically, as far as the timing of Habakkuk, this was written just very shortly before Jerusalem and the southern kingdom of Judah went into captivity. So I'm sure that all of you are familiar with the names and dates off the top of your head, right? But, I mean, you remember from the history of Israel that after the time of Solomon, the kingdom divided, and then from that point on, you had Israel and Judah, north and south. Israel went into captivity earlier because once they split off and Jeroboam introduced idolatry, the kings of the north never went back to the worship of the Lord. In the south, it was a back and forth. You know, some were bad, some were good, but so they lasted longer. But 722 BC was when the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrian Empire, capital at Nineveh. And then, you know, what we're talking about here is about 100 years later. It was around 605 BC when Judah would go into captivity. And this is just prior to that, 608, 606, you know, just before the captivity of the southern kingdom. That would be the ministry of Habakkuk. So Habakkuk then lived at the same time as Jeremiah, because Jeremiah lived in Jerusalem. He was there prior to the captivity, during the captivity. He was even carried away to Egypt when one group of them tried to rebel. So he would have been ministering at the same time as Jeremiah and King Jehoiakim and, you know, some of the other names that may or may not be familiar from Kings and Chronicles. Okay, but that's our general time frame. So we looked at the first few verses last time. You have an introduction of Habakkuk in verse number 1, very, very basic. We're not told a tremendous amount. And then in verses 2 through 11, we see the situation of Judah. You have the complaint of the righteous in verses 2 through 4. Lord, basically, how long are you going to allow this to go on? And then in verse 5, which is where we left off last time, from verses 5 through 11, we see God's response. Okay, in verses 2 through 4, the righteous folks, their complaint is being voiced by the prophet. God, why is evil being allowed to prosper? Why is it not being dealt with? Verse 5, behold you among the heathen and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. They shall scoff at kings, and princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. So, this is the response of God, again, speaking through the prophet, saying, okay, you've asked why is evil being tolerated? God says, I'm getting ready to deal with it. Now, if we're the offended party and we want God to deal with somebody else, we want God to deal with it yesterday, right? Let's get on it. But what if you are the offender? You're the one who's committed the offense. At that point in time, we're thankful for the mercy and long-suffering of God, right? So, you know, there are times when, you know, God doesn't work on the time schedule we wish he would, but always remember, we benefit from that. You know, as much as we are frustrated at times, there are other times when we definitely are the recipients of God's mercy, long-suffering as well. In verse number 5, behold ye among the heathen and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work. Now notice the time that's given there. In your days. OK? Okay? The idea here of wonder marvelously is to be astounded, to be dumbfounded, or to look with astonishment. I'm sure there have been a few instances in your life where there is just that sense of profound impact and just astonishment. I mean, 9/11 was one of those days for me, right? And for many of you in this room. Now, there's some of you that were 5 years old or less when that happened. I understand that. But for the majority of us in here, that was one of those days that just hits you. There have been times when I was sure that an election was going to go a certain way, and the official results were announced, and I was just kind of astounded, dumbfounded. You know, there are times when you get health news or family news, and it's not what you thought. Okay, but that's what God is saying here. Is that me or you guys? I see it dropped. Do I need to reconnect? All right. Oh, yes, of course I haven't purchased any music. We don't sell any. But nonetheless, God says what he's getting ready to do is going to be so significant that it's going to leave them dumbfounded. All right. And then what is the content of that? What is going to leave them dumbfounded? Okay, the timeline is in your days. Okay, so from the point of speaking by Habakkuk, it would be during the lifetime of those that were listening. Okay, many, many times the messages of the prophets were distant, right? They would say something and it wouldn't come to pass for a long time. In fact, do you remember when Daniel was in Babylon? The Bible says he set his heart to study and to understand by books the time. Whose writings did he read and gather that time? Anybody remember? Yeah, Jeremiah. Okay, he read the writings of Jeremiah and understood, okay, 70 years is the time, and he started doing the math because he was one of the ones that had been carried away in that first phase of captivity. So he began to pray that, okay, Lord, time's about up. Would you let us go back? And but anyway, Habakkuk, a lot of times it was distant like that. Jeremiah gave a prophecy and, you know, there's a long-range fulfillment. But here he says it's going to be in your days. I'll work a work which you'll not believe. All right, what is the content of that? Verse 6, lo, I raise up the Chaldeans. Okay, the way this is worded, it's literally I will cause to rise up. So this is something that God is doing. God is bringing to pass. It's not just something that happened and, you know, he tolerated it, but this is God actually raising up an enemy, an adversary, okay? And who are the Chaldeans? Well, this term Chaldeans is a lot of times interchangeable with Babylon. It's people from that region of Chaldea. It would be modern-day Iraq, that same, you know, region of the world. Now, if you remember, in Daniel, The Chaldeans were advisors to the king. You remember when King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and he needed an interpretation? He called the soothsayers, and you know, one of the listed groups there was the Chaldeans. Okay, they were supposed to be possessors of wisdom and great education and understanding and that kind of thing. But this term Chaldeans, you know, from that region is often used interchangeably. This is speaking of Babylon. Okay, they're described as that bitter and hasty nation. So it's referring to the nation. Now, many, many times the capital is used as a reference to the country, right? So Babylon would be referred to, or Chaldea would be referred to as, you know, representing the Babylonian Empire. Jerusalem was sometimes the object of attention representing Israel or Judah, depending if it's pre or post divide. Just like sometimes we talk about, man, there's probably, you know, Washington, D.C. as the capital or representative of the United States. Well, here, this is a reference not just to a group of people, but to the empire. Now, they're called here in verse 6 a bitter and hasty nation. All right, those terms are going to be explained a little bit more in verses 7 and 8. Okay, but the term bitter means that which is distasteful or unpleasant. As applied to people, it was people who were unpleasant. You know, in the context of war, they were fierce. They were unmerciful. They were people you did not want to mess with, okay? They were described as a bitter and hasty nation. What are they going to do? Which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. Okay? Now, do you like it? I mean, today we're scheduled to have a fellowship dinner. And you get there, you know, first or middle of the line, so there's still a good selection. And you have selected things that interest you. Okay? And you sit down, and then, you know, Pastor Bray would never do this, but somebody like Pastor Bray would walk up and say, "Oh, I think I'll taste that." Now, he would give you a hard time about that, but he wouldn't actually take your cupcake. He took mine, but he wouldn't take yours. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, somebody walks up and says, "Hey, that looks pretty good," and they take it off your plate. You're going to have the same response that's going to happen at some point in time in that nursery today, right? That's mine. That's not yours. Okay? Well, the Chaldeans were coming in and taking things. And when the owners would protest, "That's mine, that's not yours," they'd just kill them. Okay? That's what happened. Okay? We are in America up until this point, you know, we've been very fortunate in even if we don't agree with everything, that we have far more, you know, rights and protections than in many other times in history. Okay? But they're just going to come in and whatever they want, they take it. That's a foreign concept to us. But I mean, if you look at the conquests of David or Solomon or, you know, all of the world empires, that's exactly what happened. People just came in, took whatever they wanted, and if you complained about it, you're dead. Then you're not available to complain anymore. So God is saying, here's what's going to happen. This distasteful group is going to come in. Verse 7 gives a little more explanation on bitter. They are terrible and dreadful, their judgment. So terrible and dreadful, again, that is a reference to the fact that they were unpleasant to deal with. They were fierce. They were merciless. They were unforgiving. They were unconcerned about you, your family, or your feelings, or your property. Notice the end of verse 7, "Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves." That's an interesting term, isn't it? Okay, where was Israel supposed to get their judgments? From themselves? From God's law, right? Here, what this is saying is they had no regard for God's law. They made their own laws. They made their own judgments. This phrase, dignity, here means, well, the root word means to swell. You know, and you know, you twist your ankle, it swells. You know, you get, some of you react very strongly to mosquito bites or certain kind of bug bites. You get a bite and it swells. You know what that means, to swell or to enlarge. Okay, well, that's this word dignity has the idea of enlarging or swelling. Okay, and the idea is that they have enlarged themselves. Okay, they're swelled up, they're puffed up. So they, in their own mind, they're the dignitaries, they're the important ones. But understand, this verse 7, it proceeds of themselves. Okay, and we've already read in verse 11, they got too full of themselves, crossed the line, and God judged them. Okay, but they are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and dignity proceed of themselves. That's the bitter part. And the hasty part, what does that mean? They're a bitter and hasty nation in verse 6. Well, in verse 8, it's kind of explained. Their horses are swifter than the leopards. Now, Jeremiah also used this expression about the leopards and judgment being as swift as leopards. Okay? If you know, I'm sure some of you have watched the documentaries or the nature shows or those kind of things, and you watch, all those big cats are impressive. But the leopards here in the Old Testament were used as particular examples of being swift and unavoidable. Okay? We'll see, in the same way, their horses are compared to that. Their war horses. In other words, their armies were just as inescapable, just as fierce as leopards, and then more fierce than the evening wolves. If you remember in, I think, Micah and also Zephaniah, we've seen that. That term, the evening wolves, the wolves that come out at night, and the idea of evening wolves is that they devour. And they have no regard. In fact, in another one that we looked at previously, they didn't leave any till the morning. They just ate it all up. So that when you put that together, their war machine is swift and it's as fierce as evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves and their horsemen shall come from afar. and they shall fly as the eagle. Eagle's a really slow, lumbering bird, true or false? Yeah. Okay, so again, you have the leopards, you have the evening wolves, you have the eagles. All of these are illustrations of fast, fierce. I mean, when an eagle comes, you know, any of you men remember, you know, you remember when the fellow came a couple of years ago and brought the birds of prey demonstration? You know, talked about that and, you know, all of those things. But even fast or not, he talked about the PSI of the talons on those birds being something like 1,200 PSI or something like that. Basically, it'll crush your bones too. You know, not just a fish or a rabbit or a mouse or whatever is the object of its hunting. But all of these are swift, they're fierce, they're destructive, they're merciless. And that's the description that God is giving. He said, okay, I'm getting ready to deal with this. And when I do, this is how I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to bring in this kind of army. Verses 9 and 10, they shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind. The east wind is often connected in the Old Testament with judgment. You know, maybe a whirlwind or a strong destructive wind. Okay? And they gather the captivity as the sand. The idea here is, verse 9, you see they come for violence. They not only are performing violence, that's what they're here for. They enjoy it. Okay? It's not a necessary evil, if you will. They enjoy being violent and destructive and fierce and all of these things. They shall scoff at kings. So you see in verse 9, they delight in violence. In verse 10, they fear no opposition. They scoff at kings. Princes shall be a scorn unto them. What does that mean? Well, you see the bumper sticker or, you know, window decal sometimes, no fear. Or the Bubba version of that, ain't scared. Okay. So, you know, but the idea here is they literally, they scoffed at kings and princes. And if a king would come out with his army to oppose them, they weren't scared, they weren't bothered, they're just like, okay, you're next, and they wiped them out. Right? That's the oncoming, approaching army that is headed towards Jerusalem. So, we've read in previous books about worshiping the host of heaven on the rooftops and worshiping the idols and causing their children to pass through the fire and all of the idolatrous abominations that Judah has tolerated there in Jerusalem and in the surrounding areas. Did that go unnoticed or unpunished by God? No. And God's saying, here's what I'm getting ready to do to bring punishment of this. So when the Chaldeans come, they're delighting in violence. They fear no opposition. They are going to be able to crush everybody who stands up against them. They shall deride every stronghold. They shall heap dust. In other words, everybody that gets in their way is going to be crushed to dust. That's the idea here. Okay? So, the answer of God is, yes, I have seen, and yes, I am going to deal with it. Verse 11, well, verses 9 and 10, you see the cruelty and fearlessness of Babylon. Then in verse 11, interesting statement. Then shall his mind change. Okay? It's interesting. The word for mind there is the same word that's used in a lot of places for spirit. Okay? In other words, it's a reference to the internal of man. Okay? His internal part where he makes his decisions. You know? And so he had a change of mind, or we might sometimes say a change of heart. But his mind shall change. And he shall pass over, okay? But understand, his mind has changed and he made a different... He's carried along by his own spirit, okay? Which is why these offenses are being carried out. In some way, he's carried along by his own spirit, not necessarily led by the Spirit of God. God is using this to judge Israel, but this next phrase here, then shall his mind change and he shall pass over. Okay? To pass over is to go from this side to that side. If there's a boundary line and you pass over it, what is that called? Trespassing. Yeah, we see that all the time. No trespassing. You know, no hunting, no trespassing. Posted property, keep out. In other words, here's a line, don't cross it. Well, what this is saying then is at a certain point, he crossed a line, or the king here of Babylon, his mind changed and he shall pass over and offend. imputing this his power unto his God. So what line did he cross? If he's saying, all right, my God is the one that allowed all this to happen, then what line was crossed? Okay, idolatry, yes, ascribing power to a God other than the God of heaven. Okay, so who has he offended then? The God of heaven. Okay, the line that he's crossed is that he said, all right, my God is stronger than the God of Israel, the God of heaven. Okay, at that point, he's crossed the line. Now, Chaldeans, Babylon, have we read about any instances where the Babylonian king crossed a line and God dealt with him? You think? Can anybody think of one instance? Yeah? Huh? Yeah, when Nebuchadnezzar said, look at everything that I've done, and God turned him into an animal for 7 years. Okay? Later on, after that, there was another instance where another king of Babylon passed over and offended. What was it, Doc? You remember? Yeah, Belshazzar. When he said, bring me all the cups and bowls and whatever from the house of God in Jerusalem, and they worshiped their Babylonian gods using all the table settings and all the instruments from, you know, and that was when God sent the hand and wrote on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, or as one guy misrepresented it, money, money, tickles the parson, you know. But, you know, that's when God sent the hand and wrote on the wall and said, you're finished. So we understand with the benefit of hindsight when some of these things happened, right? But did he cross over and offend? Yes, okay. Will God deal with that? Yes. Okay, so you got like a broad scope here that's wrapped up. They may or may not have understood all of this at the time. We, with the benefit of hindsight, can understand how some of these things go together. Okay, so he crossed the line and God is going to judge them. So in verse 1's introduction, in verses 2 through 11, we have Judah's present situation. There was idolatry, there was wickedness, the righteous wanted God to deal with it. And through the prophet, God says, well, your present situation is this judgment's right around the corner. All right, then in verses 12 through 17, and then verse 1 of chapter 2, we have the next section. We have the questions of the people. Even though this is the prophet speaking, in the previous verses, in verses 2 through 4, he's kind of voicing the complaint of the people. And then verses 5 through 11, the prophet is the mouthpiece of God. Well, then in verse 12, he kind of goes back to voicing the position or the perspective of the people. Look in verse 12. Art not thou from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. All right, what they're acknowledging is, God, this is your character. And then the questions come, you know, why hasn't this been dealt with already? Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he, and makest men as the fishes of the sea and the creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with the angle. They catch them in their net and gather them in their drag. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice under their net and burn incense under their drag, because by them their portion is fat and their meat plenteous. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? So the first thing we see here in verses 12 and 13 is a question of character. Specifically, the people of Israel are saying, God, we know your character is this, so we don't understand why a holy God would tolerate this. That's in essence what they're saying. Verse 12, art thou not from everlasting? Yes, so God is eternal. Mine Holy One, God is holy. And, O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, that which is right or justice. So God is eternal, God is holy, God is just. Again, verse 13, thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil and canst not look on iniquity. Again, speaking of the holiness of God, that he is so pure that he cannot associate with wickedness or sin. So the question of the people is, God, we know this is your character, this is what you've told us. We don't understand why a holy God hasn't dealt with this. And what God's answer is, I'm in the process of doing that. Okay? That goes back to my introduction, how God doesn't always work on the schedule that we would like him to, but God does deal with things. Okay? So you have a question of God's character. Have any of these things changed? Is God still holy? Is God still from everlasting? Is God still righteous? Yes, none of those things have changed. So, but they're making their appeal. God, we know you're holy. We know you're just. We know you're the eternal God, not the passing idol of whatever nation's in charge. But God, based on that, we're asking you to do something. So you have a question of character in verses 12 and 13. In the second half of verse 13 through verse 17, you have a question of toleration. They're saying, God, we know your character. We don't understand why you're tolerating this. Verse 13, wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? In other words, God, why do you see this and let it go? Why don't you do something? Verse 14, and makest men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. Okay? Now, the fishes of the sea, okay, some of them are more solo critters. Some of them go in groups or schools, right? But what is the analogy here? Well, there's a couple of things. One, that last phrase of verse 14 where he has no ruler. In the minds of the people at this point, what was the significance of the ruler? And it's not a measuring stick. I'll go ahead and answer that one for you. It's not a measuring stick. What was one of the major functions of the ruler? To protect the people, right? Allegedly, that's the primary function of our government too. You know, for the common defense. Okay? So, what he's saying is here, why are you making men as the fishes of the sea? What ruler is over the fishes of the sea that organizes an army for the defense against the net? There is none. Okay? And that's the idea here of no ruler is no leader. No defense. And that's basically what they're saying. And then, so you have an analogy here that we're basically as defenseless as fish in the sea. When the net is cast in, other than whatever speed they have to get away, what defense do the fishes have? Nothing really. Okay? And that's the analogy here. Lord, why are you allowing men to be as the fishes of the sea and the creeping things, the other things that would fall into a different category? They take up all of them with the angle. Now, what is that reference to? That's fishing. What is another term for a fisherman? An angler. Okay? And so they take them with the angle. So that would be more like with a hook or a specific instrument. And then the net is a very broad instrument. Okay? So, in other words, you know, what they're saying is, God, you've allowed us to be caught up by some by hooks, a large group of us by nets, and gather them in their drag. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. Now, were Israelites literally caught? You know, they were all in the sea and they were caught in a net. No, this is an illustration. Okay, they said, we're as defenseless as fish against the net of a crafty fisherman. But this illustration goes on. In the end of verse 15, therefore they rejoice and are glad. Who's rejoicing? Well, the fishermen. Okay, if a fisherman has a net full of fish, they're happy, right? You got a live well full of fish, you know, when you come back on the boat, you're happy. All right? Well, here, this is an analogy that the Chaldeans are the ones who are just casting in the net, coming in with the big catch, and they're rejoicing. So verse 16 is still talking about the Chaldeans. Therefore, they sacrifice under their net and burn incense under their drag. Does that make sense? Hey, let's offer a sacrifice to our net. No. But there are instances in history of certain countries having a raised sword or that kind of thing, and they offer sacrifices and feasts in honor of that. What they were saying is the sword has brought us our prosperity. The sword has brought us our dominion. So here, when he says they sacrifice under their net and burn incense under their drags, in other words, they said, look, our tools, our weapons of war, our strategy has brought us this prosperity, has brought us our expanded empire. That's the idea here. So rather than acknowledging who, in fact, allowed the Babylonian Empire to expand, the God of heaven did. Okay, but remember in verse 11, he crossed over and offended and imputed the power unto his own God. But instead of acknowledging that it was the God of heaven who had allowed them to expand their empire, they instead are glorifying their chariots, their horses, their armor, their swords, their strategies, their whatever, the tools of their military. Therefore, they sacrifice under their net and burn incense under their drag, because by them their portion is fat. In other words, as a result of our military conquests, we now have wealth. We now live a life of luxury. That's the idea there. And their meat plenteous. Verse 17, shall they therefore empty their net? Now that does not mean, you know, letting them go. That doesn't mean letting the captives go, in case you're wondering. The idea there is the fisherman pulls in a large catch, they empty it into the boat, and then what do? They're going to throw it out again and see if they can pull in another load. And that's the idea here in verse 17. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? In other words, God, they're doing this over and over and over again. Will you do something about it? Okay, that's the idea here. So you have an illustration. So you have the question of character, not that they were challenging God's character, but they're saying, God, this is who we understand you to be, and you haven't acted the way we thought you would. But based on your character, God, we don't understand why you're tolerating this and why you're allowing all of this to go on. Again, this is somewhat prophetic of what the Chaldeans are going to do. Okay, and then in chapter 2, verse 1, we have a question of timing. Chapter 2 and verse 1, I will stand upon my watch. Now, that doesn't mean you take that little timepiece off your wrist and stand on it. Okay? Rather, this is the idea of the watchman standing on the tower. Okay? So I'm going to stand at my post, at my observation position. I will stand on my watch and set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say unto me. Okay? This term watch here has the idea of to look or spy, okay? In other words, it has the idea of to watch with intensity. The verb itself has the idea of intensity. In other words, it's not like, you know, you're sitting on the porch at the end of the day and you kind of see what's going on, but you're not really paying attention to what cars go by or who walks by, you know, down the road, or, you know, you're seeing things, but it's kind of casual. No, this is the idea of the watchman giving careful attention because lives depend on it. So there is an intensity to this here. This is kind of a shift in perspective. It's as though the prophet has said, okay, Lord, you know, here's our questions. Now I'm waiting for an answer. Verse 1, he says, I will stand on my watch and set me upon the tower and watch to see what he will say unto me. And then the next phrase, and what I shall answer when I'm reproved. He said, here's my complaint, so now I'm going to wait on God to answer, and if he tells me I'm wrong, then I'm going to think about how I need to respond. That's the idea here. But the question of timing is, all right, I've made my request, now I'm going to wait and see when God answers. Okay, that's not always our most desirable part of the process, right? Lord, I've made my request, when are you going to give me an answer? Okay, you know, Lord, give me patience and give it to me now. That's our general approach usually, right? So the idea is, all right, here's my request, and I'm going to wait on you to answer me. So you have a little bit of a shift in perspective. He's speaking for the people, he's speaking for the Lord, and now the prophet on behalf of the people says, Lord, you know, we're going to wait on you. But it's not just a casual, disinterested type of a watch and a wait. It is a focused, intense, you know, awaiting with expectation, awaiting with a sense of urgency. Okay? They are looking for God's answer. All right? So, chapter 1, we have the situation of Judah and God's response. I'm going to bring judgment. All right? Then, again, in chapter 2, verse 2 through 20, it's the rest of chapter 2, then we have the answer of God. Okay, in chapter 1, the prophet says, all right, I'm going to wait. You know, I'm going to intensely wait, but I'm just going to wait and see when the Lord answers. Verse 2, the Lord answered me. Okay, and in the rest of this, you have an answer of God. The Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon the tables, that he may run that readeth it. Okay, so now if you remember in chapter 1, verse number 5, he said, I'm going to work a work in your days. And he begins to say, all right, I'm going to bring the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation. So part of this is, all right, this is going to happen immediately. But this wording here in verse number 2, write the vision and make it plain upon the tables, that he may run that readeth it. Now, all of you probably don't have the same curiosity that I do, and I understand that. But I hope as we read this together, you at least think, make it plain upon the tables. What is that? Okay. Most of the commentators, there's kind of a consensus that a lot of times what would happen is the oral messages of the prophets, whether it was God, a vision of God, you know, whatever, but the messages of the prophets often would be written down on tables or reed tablet, okay? Or if it wasn't the full thing, it was kind of the cliff notes, the bullet points, condensed version. Those would be written down, and there would be tablets that would be posted at the house of God. There are some records of, historical records of different places where there was a room full of tablets with the messages of the prophets and so forth. So I take this to mean write the vision and make it plain upon the tables. Is not only that Habakkuk is delivering this orally, but he's going to write it down and post it as a notice, so that folks that come to the house of God or folks that pass by will be made aware of the content of this message as well. Okay, that's the idea here. Write the vision, make it plain upon the tables. What that means is I would have to have somebody else write it for me. Because if you've ever seen my handwriting, there's a reason I spend a lot of time learning to type. But have somebody write it in a way that would be legible, and that he may run that readeth it. In other words, you're going to want to run away from this judgment that's coming. But you see here the timing of the vision. Why did this need to be written down? Look at verse 3. The vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it. Because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Wait a minute. Though it tarry, it'll not tarry. What does that mean? That means from man's perspective, it's going to feel like it's tarrying or delaying, or if I could use another word, it's tardy. It's late. But you see the phrase there, appointed time? The vision is yet for an appointed time. That is a very specific wording there. Okay? The appointed time was specific in the mind of God, but it was unspecified to the hearers. Okay? So this idea of appointed time, they're going to think, well, when is this ever going to happen? It's not that God's tardy, not that God's late, but just simply that God's time is not yet. But when God says now, then it won't delay. When God says now, then it's going to happen just like he wanted it to. That's the idea here. So the timeline on this particular one has more of a long-range view. All right? So some of the things are immediate, some of them are more long-range, but it's kind of interesting to see, you know, the back and forth in the perspective of the prophet. So we have the time of the vision's fulfillment, and then in verse 4 we have the offenses listed, but we're out of time already. Or some of you say mercifully. But anyway, it's time for us to wrap it up for today. So we will pick up there at verse number 4 next time, Lord willing. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord.